We are continuing our series here in 1 Samuel. And as you recall, God is in the process of giving the people of Israel what they want instead of what they need. But this actually is a kind or a version of what they need, because they think they need an earthly ruler like the other nations around them. They think they need someone who can just get rid of their enemies without having that victory depend on their faithfulness to God. However, that is not what they need. What they need is someone who leads them to God, who helps them to be faithful to Him. And so God will give them exactly what they want, as they are starry-eyed every time they look at the handsome King Saul, who instead of delivering them is out plowing fields. But when they get a glimpse of him, they're reminded, wow, this is the guy we want. Remember, the scriptures didn't only fail to leave out his relationship to the Lord. They didn't even mention anything he was gifted in leading. Because he was mighty in battle, because he was wise, because he was courageous, nothing. It's only he looks really good. And Israel said, yeah, and that's our guy. And then when they're in need, he's out plowing fields, and they still don't say, okay, bad idea. God, can we have you back? So God is giving them an extra dose of, okay, this is what you wanted. I'm giving this to you to show you that what you want is not what you need. I want you to desire what you need, and what you need is me. And so he's giving them what they want. He's designing it to fail so that they want better. Please know, God does that for us. He structures our lives to show us, here's what you need. That is a loving thing on his part. It would make total sense for God, according to human wisdom, to say, you want Saul? Okay. He's totally inept. I'll give him to you. And then the Philistines are going to come in and destroy you, because I'm done with you. I don't have a patience for this kind of garbage anymore. That would make total sense. We'd say, yep, that's what I would have done. Praise God, he doesn't do what we would have done. He does not act according to the wisdom of the world. He acts according to his incomparable wisdom. And so, when we look elsewhere, how does the Lord draw us back to him? Hear now the word of the Lord, 1 Samuel chapter 12, verse 1. Then Samuel said to all Israel, I have carefully listened to everything you said. Everything you said to me and placed a king over you. Now you can see that the king is leading you. As for me, I'm old and gray, and my sons are here with you. I have led you from my youth until now. Here I am. Bring charges against me before the Lord and his anointed. Whose ox or donkey have I taken? Who have I wronged or mistreated? Who gave me a bribe to overlook something? I will return it to you. You haven't wronged us, you haven't mistreated us, and you haven't taken anything from anyone, they responded. He said to them, the Lord is a witness against you, and his anointed is a witness today that you haven't found anything in my hand. He is a witness, they said. Then Samuel said to the people, the Lord who appointed Moses and Aaron and who brought your ancestors up from the land of Egypt is a witness. Now, present yourselves so I may confront you before the Lord about all the righteous acts he has done for you and your ancestors. When Jacob went to Egypt, your ancestors cried out to the Lord, and he sent them Moses and Aaron, who led your ancestors out of Egypt and settled them in this place. but they forgot the Lord their God. So he handed them over to Sisera, commander of the army of Hazor, to the Philistines, and to the king of Moab. These enemies fought against them, and then they cried out to the Lord and said, "We have sinned, for we have abandoned the Lord and worshipped the Baals and the Ashtoreths. Now rescue us from the power of your enemies, and we will serve you." So the Lord sent Jerubbaal, that's Gideon, Barak, Jephthah, and Samuel. He rescued you from the power of the enemies around you, and you lived securely. But when you saw that Nahash, remember that serpent? But when you saw that Nahash, king of the Ammonites, was coming against you, you said to me, "No, we must have a king reign over us, even though the Lord your God is your king. Now, here's the king you've chosen, the one you requested. Look, this is the king the Lord has placed over you. If you fear the Lord, worship and obey him. And if you don't rebel against the Lord's command, then both you and the king who reigns over you will follow the Lord your God. However, if you disobey the Lord and rebel against his command, the Lord's hand will be against you, as it was against your ancestors. Now, therefore, present yourselves and see this great thing that the Lord will do before your eyes. Isn't the wheat harvest today? I will call on the Lord, and he will send thunder and rain so that you will recognize what an immense evil you've committed against the Lord's sight by requesting a king for yourselves." Samuel called on the Lord, and on that day the Lord sent thunder and rain. As a result, the people greatly feared the Lord and Samuel. They pleaded with Samuel, "Pray to the Lord your God for your servants, so we won't die. For we have added to all our sins the evil of requesting a king for ourselves." Samuel replied, please see how crazy this reply is. Samuel replied, "Don't be afraid. Even though you have committed all this evil, don't turn away from following the Lord. Instead, worship the Lord with all your heart. Don't turn away to follow worthless things that can't profit or rescue you. They are worthless. The Lord will not abandon his people because of his great name and because he has determined to make you his own people. As for me, I vow that I will not sin against the Lord by ceasing to pray for you. I will teach you the good and the right way. Above all, fear," meaning revere, "fear, revere the Lord and worship him faithfully with all your heart. Consider the great things he has done for you. However, if you continue to do what is evil, both you and your king will be swept away." The word of the Lord. And now, awkward transition to the kids' sermon. Maybe less awkward thanks to the fact that I sound very fearful to you this morning. So, kids, what is God saying to you this morning? He loves you, and he wants you to know that. It can be easy to forget, not because he is forgetful, he's perfect, but we do silly things and forget how much he loves us. But he wants you to know also how you can show God that you're thankful that he loves you and how you can love him. So, I'm going to ask you a question that might sound a little bit weird. Do your parents ever let you fail at something? Think about that for a second. Maybe you have said, "Oh, I can pick that up. I can carry that thing." And they said, no, it's too heavy. You can't do it. Let me do it." And you say, "Oh, no, I can do it." And maybe they said, "Okay, try and pick it up." And maybe you tried and "Okay, it's too heavy. You have to pick it up." Why would they let you do that if they knew you couldn't pick it up. Well, they wanted to help you remember that they know what's best for you. They know what's wise for you because they love you. And you weren't remembering that their words were things that were there to help you. You weren't remembering that you should trust them. And so they let you see, all right, you don't know what's best. I'll let you remember that I know what's best for you. Do kids like remembering that their parents know what's best? Probably not too much, right? You probably like thinking that you know what's best. And you know what? Grown-ups think that way too. Because a lot of times everyone, kids and grown-ups, don't like to think that God knows what's best for us and we should trust His word. But a lot of times we like to think, nah, I'm fine the way I am. I don't need to rely on God. So kids, when your parents show you those lessons, it's because they love you. But God shows us these lessons too. And He shows us in the verses that I read to you today, the people of Israel think they need a human king. But they already had God as their king. Who would want a human instead of God? He's clearly more strong and wise and mighty than any human. So God lets them, okay, here's your human king. He's not going to work out very well because I want you to see that you need me more than what you think you need. And that's actually kind that God does that, right? To show them, no, you need me, because He could just say, fine, you want a human king? Take him and I'm done with you. God doesn't do that for them, and I hope you're really grateful, kids. He doesn't do that for us. He doesn't say, I'm done with you when we fail. He says, I'll teach you a lesson so that you come back to me. Because God will always love you, kids, if you trust in Jesus. Even when you do think other things are more important than God, even when you do fail, Jesus said, punish me for that. Isn't that amazing? Jesus wanted to pay your punishment for you so you could live forever with God and all the saints forever. So kids, remember that and think about those things during this sermon, okay? Thank you for listening. Okay, so how does God protect us from turning away from Him? We looked last week at how He leads us back, but how does He protect us from even turning in the first place? We see this lesson here with Israel. First, in this story here, He reminds us of our need for Him. When we would be tempted to look elsewhere for our hope, for our security, for our fulfillment, He reminds us of our need for Him. And then He reminds us of His incomparable greatness. Not just we need Him, but maybe I need Him and something else. No, nothing compares to Him. So He reminds us of His incomparable greatness. And finally, He reminds us why His promises are sure. Not just that they're sure, but specifically, why are they sure? So, first point, He reminds us of our need for Him. So Samuel confronts the people and first says, okay, you're in a terrible position with your suzerain, with your great king, with your emperor, Yahweh. Have I brought you to this point? Did I do something wrong as your leader? Did I take bribes? Did I lead poorly? He asks them all, and they all say what? No, you've been perfect. Okay, now that we've cleared that up, why are you in this position with God that you're wanting to reject Him? I didn't bring you here. I warned you against this. You have persisted in this. So I'm calling you to account, and God is witness here that you are rejecting him for no good reason whatsoever. And they don't defend themselves, and yet they don't change their mind. They sit there quietly like, true. No, you've done nothing wrong. He hasn't either, but we're not changing our minds. And I hope you see, again, this is what sin is. Absolute folly. Absolute irrational thinking. And so then he adds to that saying, okay, so I've not wronged you. Why don't we reconsider how God has treated you ever since the beginning? So let's see if he's wronged you as far as why you want to move on from him. Led you out of Egypt. That was pretty amazing. By the way, you then turned on him and he redeemed you anyway. And you turned on him again and again and again. And every time things got bad for you and you decided, oh, maybe I should cry out to God, he still showed up. And on top of that, he did it through giving you leaders. He only mentions four judges. He could have mentioned them all. He gave you leaders that specifically he worked through that defeated your oppressors. So it's not just that he knew what was best for you. He knew how to give you a human leader that would fix your problems. He's always done that for you. So why are you moving on from this system where God's judge can do exactly what you need? Because he is empowering that judge. Why are you moving on? Don't really have an answer, but we're sticking with our position here. We're moving on. Please see the similarity between the sinful patterns in our own life. No, this stuff's not okay, but it's more convenient if I keep living this way. Absolute folly. So remember, asking for a king isn't the problem. It's the kind of king they want that's the problem. God actually had promised Abraham and Jacob as part of his blessing to them, I'm going to make you into a great nation. And it's actually when he changed both of their names. You're not Abram, now you're Abraham. You're not Jacob, now you're Israel. I am going to do great things through you. And the blessing he mentions with both of them is you're going to be a great nation and kings, plural. Kings will come from you. It's a good thing. So not just the king, one of these days the Messiah is going to come from you. That's what these kings point to, obviously, but kings will come from you. We're going to go that direction. It's going to be a blessing. It's a sign of my kindness to you. We already covered Deuteronomy 17 a few weeks ago when God says, when you get in the land and you're going to need a king, here's what he should do. Not accrue wives and wealth and everything for himself. He should point the people to Yahweh. So a good king is an absolute blessing to the people. But they want a king like the other nations. And what did those kings do? I've mentioned to you already, they were to manipulate the God or, and this is behind their thinking, maybe multiple gods. You, the king, can do various rituals, various things to get this one god or multiple gods, the more the merrier, to do what we need. And it depends on you doing your job. And that's great because right now Yahweh only fights for us when we do what he wants. And we're tired of that. We don't want success to depend on our following Yahweh. So let's get a king in place. He'll do the job of getting the God in favor of us and maybe multiple gods because we could use all the help we can get. And kings usually require, and this is absolutely what they're saying here, a standing army. God already warned them what that would cost them. And now it's in the king's interest not to lose a battle. Doesn't depend on us. He's got his army. He doesn't want to lose face in the social scene. If he loses his army, he loses wealth. Let's make this depend on somebody other than our faithfulness to Yahweh, because we're tired of that. Why? Because we're not very good at it. Why? Because we don't trust him, even though he's never once let us down. So, this goes back to what this book has been harping on since chapter 1. This is about people wanting to approach God on their terms and not on his. So it's not saying there is no God, there is no Yahweh. It's sure he's there. And he's done some good things. And I'd like to benefit from those good things on my terms. And before we look too judgingly on them, please know that is all of our besetting sin. Sure, I love the comfort I get from Christ's work. I love knowing that everything's forgiven. Therefore, I love to do what I want, knowing that I won't be rejected. It's presuming on his grace. It's the opposite of what God called the Galatians to do when he said, it's for freedom that Christ sets you free, but don't use your freedom to serve yourself. Use your freedom from fear of a death sentence that you absolutely deserve. Use the freedom from that to serve. To say, Lord, thank you that you took that death for me. Therefore, who can I serve as you have served me? So they are indeed fully rejecting Yahweh, but again, they are acting like they haven't. No. We're still calling out to you. We're just adding to what we hope in. It's you plus. And I think that is another besetting sin of all of us. Though none of us would say, Lord, I pray to you to care for me. Amen. Now, job, I pray to you to care for me. We don't do that stuff. But if we graft and charted out the time we spend thinking about, worrying about, whatever it is that consumes our day, I think all of us will be shown to be doing exactly the opposite of Christ, of Christ's commands when he said, why are you worrying about these things? God clothed the lilies, plants that die, with greater glory than Solomon himself. Don't you think he cares more about you? Oh, that's great. Anyway, back to worrying. Okay. So, to help move them from that place, and again, to help move us from that place as we see, hopefully, as we learn from their example, he reminds them, where would you be without me? Where would you be if I wasn't the one rescuing you all the time? So he gives them an often repeated history lesson. It's said over and over again by the prophets, the Psalms, and so often in the historical books. All right, you've decided to follow another God again. Let's remember how we got here. You were oppressed in Egypt. You had no power to free yourselves. I came in and freed you in an absolutely just fantastic way. I took on 10 different Egyptian gods in each plague and showed why I'm superior to them. Not only that, when I freed you, I routed their army. They're dead. They're at the bottom of the Red Sea. Go check it out. You couldn't have done any of that. I did it all, even when you were doubting me the whole time. And I haven't ceased to continue to do that through the period of the judges. So why are you looking for somebody else again? And he reminds them that when you did call out to me in the period of the judges, and I delivered you, he says specifically, you rested securely. How can anything else give you that security that only I can give to you? So why is he repeating something that he's repeated to them so often? They've heard this lesson so many times. They don't lack this information? Well, even though people in our own denomination have said this is a worthless thing to tell people, they forget the gospel, they know the gospel, they don't need to hear it again, then why does God do this? It's not that we are like, hold on, what happened in Egypt? There was an Exodus? Red Sea, what are you talking? No one would have replied that way. Of course, they knew the information. It was not informing them the way that it should. It was not shaping them the way that it should. It was not determining their decisions the way that it should have. And instead of God saying, fine, I've told you too many times, I'm gone, his kindness says, I will tell you again. And that's what every Lord's Day should be about. Rehearsing things we know, but things that need to shape how we think and how we act more than they do. So, they are in the process of rejecting Yahweh. But they didn't say, there is no God, there is no Yahweh. Baal is God, not you. They didn't say that. But God says, you're rejecting me if you're saying Yahweh plus. So please, please take it to heart. When you are discovering through God's kindness that you are saying the gospel, Christ, all he's done, plus. Not through your words, likely, but through your actions. That is rejecting him. Now, your rejections there cannot result in severing you from him, which is amazing. I hope you think it's amazing. But please know, why would I want to do things that equal rejection of my God after all he's done for me? See the folly of what they're doing in our own Yahweh or the gospel or Christ plus attitudes. So to help protect them from going down that road, he says, look where you'd be without me. Could any human have delivered you from Egypt? Could any human have defeated these different enemies that I defeated for you? No. He kind of continues that by showing them his incomparable greatness. It's not just that I did this, but maybe somebody else could have. No, nobody else could have. So verse 12, he then goes to a very recent history and says, but when you saw that Nahash, king of the Ammonites, was coming against you, you said to me, no, we must have a king reign over us, even though the Lord your God is your king. Now, here's the king you've chosen, the one you requested. Look, this is the king the Lord has placed over you. So how much better is the Lord than what they've asked for? And again, the Lord's providence is incredible. The name Saul means the one asked for, right? Probably because his parents asked, Lord, give us a child. But the Lord knew what he was going to do. The one asked for. And remember, their language didn't work like what we're doing. They were not saying Saul, which actually means the one asked for. Like, the one asked for is king. Right? That's the word they would have used for that phrase. Just like Nahash would have meant, oh, serpent is attacking us. Not like Nahash, which means serpent. It's what the word they would, it's the word they would have used. So the Lord is saying, when serpent attacked you cruelly and sought to humiliate you, you went to find the one asked for. He was doing nothing for you. Actually, you had to find him when he was out plowing fields. You were originally asked for him, and I gave him to you to defeat the Philistines, which he has done nothing to do whatsoever. He's out plowing fields, and the Ammonites, specifically Nahash, serpent, has been attacking the tribe of Reuben and Gad, already doing this. Now it's moved to Jabesh-Gilead. And now you came to find, where's the one asked for? Who had done nothing. And afterwards, when you didn't call on me at all, and I still delivered you by putting my spirit in Saul to move in a way that defeated this accuser. You still said, I want Saul. I want the one asked for. Even though Saul could have done nothing, would have stayed plowing in that field if my spirit hadn't moved him, if I hadn't done what you need to save you. And no one's contradicting that that's what happened. They're still saying, got it. Can I have Saul, please? And I don't think that, again, we say, I don't need Jesus. We say, I absolutely need Jesus and this raise and this restored marriage and this healing and this reputation, whatever it is that occupies so much of our time. So God also reminds them, though I have given you what you asked for, by the way, you guys still have to obey me. And he has to still obey me. Though you asked for him, thinking now, okay, I can do what I want, you actually can't, because I won't let you destroy yourselves, which is what that would do. So in verse 14, he says, if you fear the Lord and worship and obey him, and if you don't rebel against the Lord's command, then both you and the king who reigns over you will follow the Lord your God. However, if you disobey the Lord and rebel against his command, the Lord's hand will be against you as it was your ancestors. So while they're sitting there saying, sure, yeah, we hear you, but we still want Saul. God says, I gave you Saul, but it's as a babysitter, one scholar has said. And early on, I mentioned this before, but he never uses the word early on. He does later, but early on, they said, we want a king, and he basically says, I'll give you a prince. We want a king, I'll give you a vice ruler, but I'm not going away. And that's good for you. And they're kind of saying, okay, cool, can I have Saul? Great, can I have earthly hope? Great, can I not have to rely on your faithfulness? Can I not have to rely on faith in your promises? Can I have the benefits of that, but get what I want on my terms? He reminds them, as Hannah prayed that the Lord would thunder against his foes, and as you remember, you were weaponless when you turned to me and the Philistines surprised you, and how did I win that battle? I thundered against them. It's like the exact sound a lot of our Bibles kind of euphemize when Adam sinned. And then he heard the sound of the Lord walking in the garden. That's not footsteps on dried leaves. It's probably a thundering wind. It's, we're doomed. That sound means we're doomed. God thunders now against them. He says, is it not the wheat harvest today? That time of year, it would have been probably early May and June, in that part of the world, is very dry. There's no chance of a thunderstorm. But again, remember, it was the thunderstorm that destroyed the Philistines. It came out of nowhere. The skies were clear blue, and all of a sudden they're black. Clearly, this is a God against us. Now God is showing them, do you remember what you deserve? You deserve me being against you, and I'm going to show you what that looks like. Boom, out of nowhere, Samuel calls down the storm. And what's the point? Can any human do this? Could Saul have called down this storm? Could any of you? Could any temporal power have called down this storm? Of course not. Why are you choosing these other things instead of the all-powerful and loving God? And the Israelites are realizing the position they're in because they say, in verse 8, don't stop crying out to the Lord, your God. Sorry, not verse 8. I'm losing the verse it's in. Anyway, they say, sorry, don't stop crying out to the Lord, your God. But when they faced the Philistines and he saved them In chapter 7, verse 8, that's where I got that, they specifically said, Samuel, don't stop crying out to the Lord our God. So they're realizing, I am putting my trust in this other power. That means Yahweh is not my God, but I still want the benefits of it. Samuel, can you get us something? Cry out to your God for us? Please, I beg you, ask the Lord to show you where you do the same thing. Where your actions say, of course I need Jesus, but I need this more right now. I need to think about this right now. Gospel, I got it, but right now, this is more important. Please ask the Lord to show you where our actions are as foolish as what we see here. So God is showing us this in Israel to help us learn the lesson on the pages of his word so we don't learn it from realizing, why did I do this again? Right? He's still faithful to keep us from turning from him ultimately. But isn't it better to learn this lesson from his word instead of, how did I get myself here again? So to help keep us from turning from him, he reminds us, do you see how badly you need me? How nothing else can do what I can do for you? On top of that, do you see how incomparable my great power is compared to anything else you might trust in? You want Saul. He's out plowing fields. God can call the storm immediately. And you want the guy out ignoring your problems? No, God is incomparably greater than anything else we might put our hope in. So finally, he shows us not just that he's great and greater than anything else, and here's why my promises are sure. Not just that his promises are sure, why? And that question, why are they sure? I'm sure is generated in many of you, but here's the reason why it should be generated in you, not because he's got a bad track record, because you do, and I do. Why would he keep promises to somebody like me? Why would someone like me be sure that God is going to be favorable to them? In verse 22, the Lord says, the Lord will not abandon his people because of his great name. And because he has determined to make you his own people. Why can you have confidence that God will not abandon someone who does the things you do, who thinks the way you do, who fails him the way you do? Because he said he won't. Because of his great name. He swore on his own name. Hebrews 6 says, when Abraham asked, God, why can I be sure of your promises? I'm convinced that Abraham was also doubting his track record, not God's. I know you promised me great things, but let's look at my track record. I have not acted like one who believes your promises. So how sure are these things? So when Abraham asked that, God swore on himself. Because what greater power can he swear on? Here's how you can be sure, Abraham, because of this created thing that I made. Well, that's less than him. He goes to the top. You can be sure I'm going to deliver because I'm the one who promised it. And I will not violate my own reputation. I can't be not God. And part of who I am means I keep promises. So it's not just that God won't break a promise. God can't break it. And if there's any inkling in you that says, oh, I kind of want a God to say that he's going to keep his promise because of these good things in me that he really valued. What if you stop doing those things? There goes his promises if they depended on what you were doing, on what you brought to the table. You want God's promises to depend on nothing you bring, and you want them to be on what he brings, because he can't fail, and you, not just might, you will, and so will I. It's wonderful news to hear that God says, here's why you people who are rejecting me, who are faithless, who are turning away from me will still, at the end of the day, be redeemed and brought back to me. You want to know why? Because I said I will. Because I said I won't abandon you. And that is the essence of why the gospel is good news. Because of his great name. And then he shows through Samuel, the one pointing ahead to the kind of leader we actually need, he shows us, and here's what my name brings you. Samuel says, I promise I will not sin against the Lord by failing to intercede for you or guide you. And that is what Christ has done. I tried to emphasize it in my reading of the text. It was amazing that after the thunderstorm, after this powerful sign of God's wrath, did you hear what Samuel said to the people? Don't be afraid. Wasn't that the point? Wasn't that the point of the thunderstorm? To scare everybody straight? No, it says, do you see how powerful God is? Trust in him. He won't turn on you. The king will most certainly fail you and tax you and do all kinds of terrible things. He's already shown himself to be a completely inept person. The God who can bring a thunderstorm, can bring wrath, will not bring it on those who trust in him. So follow after him. That makes sense. Earthly, temporal things that will fail make no sense. So first, he shows us what we deserve. The thunderstorm didn't take any of them. It could have. God showed them, here's what you deserve, but it's not going to take you. So trust in the one who can deliver you and the one who delights to show mercy, who delights to save those who are wandering, who don't trust the way they should. But then he also shows that, and I will not fail to continue to teach you. We don't just receive salvation. The Lord continues to guide us and protect us from these false alternatives that often present themselves as better options than Christ alone. And all this reminds us of the language we receive from Paul, and ultimately, obviously, from the Lord. In 2 Timothy 2, verse 11, Paul exhorts us with these comforting words. This saying is trustworthy, for if we died with him, we will also live with him. If we endure, we will also reign with him. If we deny him, he will deny us. But if we are faithless, he remains faithful. For he cannot deny us. He cannot deny himself. What does that go back to? You're safe because I have sworn in my name. It all depends on him. So when you find yourself racked with worry, consumed with desire for temporal things, wasting your energy on, if this just works out, I'll be fine. Whatever it is that plagues you, whatever temptations draw you away from, no, I'm okay because of the Lord. Remember this lesson. Remember this picture. This people who is saying, no, I think we need Saul more than you. God says, I will not abandon you. Here's what you deserve. But I'm not going to give you what you deserve. Turn to me. Look to the one I've given you who will intercede for you and comfort you and guide you back to me. If we are faithless, he remains faithful. For he cannot deny himself. He has sworn on his own name. You struggling sinner, who has trusted in Christ will never get away from him. Though you try, you will never get away. He will keep you will guide you and protect you from ultimately turning away from him. Because he promised you won't get away. He promised what? What I've started, I will complete. I'm the author and the finisher. Therefore, all of mine will not ever be taken out of the Father's hands.